you look at your business and it's actually completely unaligned with your business plan, you've got a problem. You even need to write a new plan, or, you know, you need to come up with a new way of working. If you're not hitting your numbers, it's just going to continue to get worse. So I think you've got to be very real. Is my business generating the numbers it needs to grow and survive and thrive? If the fundamentals are not there, it's not going to happen.
It's the E-commerce Master Plan podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. We're getting stuck straight into it this episode. So I've got someone coming on who is willing to talk about how and why they decided to close their e-commerce store. Something I know quite a lot of you are mulling in 2024, and mulling as we go towards the Christmas January period where the writing ends up on the wall for a lot of e-commerce stores. So really fascinating chat coming up on what it takes to close one down, how to make the decisions, what it means generally for e-commerce business. Lots of interesting things coming up in this episode. Even if you're not thinking of closing, trust me, you're going to get some good insights from this guest. So please make sure you listen right to the end of the episode so you don't miss out on their top tips and my own take on this episode. Have you yet downloaded our ebook? To celebrate reaching episode 500, we've created an epic e-commerce success-focused ebook for you, packed with 500, yes, 500 top tips about how to make your e-commerce store more profitable, featuring the advice of many, many past guests alongside industry experts and many of you as well, our listeners. I've checked every single tip and organise the whole thing into sections for you, making it super easy to dip in and dip out and take inspiration as and when you need it. This ebook needs to be sat on your desktop or even printed and sat on your desk. Download your free copy right now at ecmp.info/ebook. Get 2024's most valuable e-commerce ebook now, ecmp.info/ebook. And now to introduce our special guest. Mike Stevens is one of the D2C pioneers, with 8 years at Innocent Drinks back in the 2000s, and then founding Good For You confectionery brand Peppersmith, which over 10 years he scaled all the way to exit in 2018. He's also the author of the excellent and best-selling and award-winning book, The Direct-to-Consumer Playbook, the stories and strategies of the brands that wrote the D2C rules. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Chloe. Good to talk to you again.
Brilliant to have you back on the show and talking about such an interesting subject. But before we get into that, have you been since we last caught up?
Yeah, good. I mean, we're going to talk about it, but you've been pretty busy. You know, I've been up to lots of different things. One of them was after, you know, the book was really well received. So, you know, the Direct Consumer Playbook, which we can talk about again if any of your guests didn't catch the last episode, was a really great thing to do. But yes, I've been sort of using that content a lot, but you know, mostly around helping people. So I do a lot of consulting, but one of the big things I really wanted to do was kick off a new brand, which I did, and we'll talk about how we got on with that.
Indeed you did. So what was this brand that you began back in 2022?
Yeah, so it was 2022, which seems quite a long time ago now. So I guess the thing is about me, you know, I've been sort of consumer driven, entrepreneurial since start of 2000. So, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, I had this fantastic introduction to the world of consumer goods at Innocent Drinks. You know, that was just a brilliant place to learn sort of how you do scale up, challenge your brands. So I took all that learning into Peppersmith, and Peppersmith was really successful. So that was great. And then obviously, you know, I wrote the book, which is primarily about helping people with their own direct-to-consumer journeys. If you've got a brand, how you think about direct consumer businesses and how it fits in your overall business, not just a channel, what it actually means to your business. But it's always, you know, I've always been, okay, what's the, I guess, the next consumer brand that I'm going to help? So the book was a great way of helping consumer brands. My consulting is I help lots of startup and challenger brands, but I was always ready to do my own thing again. So, I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote the book is I needed a bit of a break. I mean, founding the business and scaling the business and ultimately selling the business over a 10-year period, that's hard. You know, don't let anyone tell you that's easy. So when I sold Peppersmith in 2018 and exited in 2019, to be honest, I was ready for a bit of a break. And but you know what they say, a break's not just sitting on the beach. It's a change is as good as a rest. So I decided to write the book. So the direct to consumer playbook came out of that. And that was a fantastic journey in itself, and so, you know, meeting, you know, all these awesome founders of the best D2C brands around, chatting to them about, you know, how they built their businesses, comparing it to, you know, what I've done, and trying to, you know, put together all those lessons. That was fantastic. But that was, you know, I guess that's a change from what I love doing, which is actually making, building, and making sure people can get hold of just awesome consumer goods. And goods that I guess made better than what's come before. So, you know, I was always going to do something new again, but the book was just a way of, I guess, transitioning from one brand to a new brand. So yeah, 2022, I started Kuroa.
So almost like a purging or a detox type scenario. I'm going to put everything down in the book, get away from the day to day and wait for the next big idea to come along.
Yeah, and that's it. And in terms of the big idea, and I guess, you know, most founders really know this, it's not just sort of one big idea. You don't often just wake up in the morning and you've got the big idea. It takes a long time to sort of, you know, to build, ferment. Most entrepreneurs that I know, they have been thinking about their idea for a long time before they actually start the business. So in terms of, you know, me starting a new brand, I definitely had some criteria, and the criteria was a big thing. I mean, it had to be sort of a big category, sustainability focused, but also with functional attributes. I mean, functionalities, you know, is a really key thing. It has to have benefits. And then it also had to be, you know, needed to be able to start with, you know, I guess a specific product or a range, but with the ability to go multi-channel, multi-range to actually build, you know, a big business. So they're all the things that I looked at. And, you know, I looked at lots of different types of products and categories, but where I really fell in love, it happened very much by accident. So I was, you know, in my consulting world, I actually had my old Amazon consultancy provider, you know, Amazon agency who helped me with Peppersmith, mm-hmm. You know, with Amazon. I know you probably talk a lot about Amazon on this podcast. So yeah, my journey with Amazon, you know, with Peppersmith, we did it all ourselves to start. We were on the first food and drink brands on Amazon UK, and we learned how to do it. And then it got all of a sudden, I guess, in the back end of, you know, sort of, you know, from 2016 onwards, it started getting very, very complicated. And then it made sense to actually get some external help to, you know, work out how we best manage it. So working with a great guy called Mark, and he's in there. We built up a relationship. He helped Peppersmith in terms of its Amazon journey. But he one day he came to me and said, Mike, I love my agency. I really do. But I also want to see what it's like on the other side. I want to bring my own consumer product to market. I was like, can you help me? I was like, of course I can help you, man. This is what I do. You know, you've been helping me for a long time, so now it's my chance to help you. I'd love to do that. And he talked me through these different ideas he had. Again, entrepreneur, you don't have just one idea. You have multiple ideas. And we talked about lots of things. We talked about supplements. We talked about, you know, some dog food. But one of the things, you know, he said to me, he's like, Mike, I've just bought some bamboo bedding because I've just bought a house, and I'm really quite into it. Maybe bamboo bedding is the answer. And I was like, whoa, maybe, but it might not be bamboo and it might not be bedding, you know, but let's have a think about that category. That seems like quite, you know, that seems like a category. And then, you know, so I went on a bit of a journey sort of looking at the homeware category. And what I found was a super conservative, old-fashioned, commoditized category. Yeah, and that's homeware. And the reason I got excited about that is not because it sort of was a bit in the, you know, it was sort of doing things in the past, I guess. And this is a bit like Peppersmith. You know, when we started Peppersmith, a confectionery, we found a category that had been very sleepy and doing the same things for 50 years. I found the same things in homeware. It's like, oh, man, you know, this hasn't really developed. This is all a bit strange for me. But the reason I got really excited about it was alongside, I guess, homeware. And I guess we're talking, when we talk about homeware, I'm not talking about sort of kitchenware. I'm talking about duvets and curtains and, I guess, you know, towels. You know, textiles, home textiles, essentially. So in the textile world, there's been a load of amazing stuff happening in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, particularly in fashion and particularly in, I guess, functional sports fashion. I mean, the brands, you know, I mean, Patagonia is the biggest one, but there's other brands. There's Hyatt Denim, there's Hilo Shoes, there's Pangaea. And I guess all of these businesses, they've been just doing really cool stuff in material science. So they've been making really cool clothes, but made of materials that are either functionally better or sustainably better. And most of the time, they're both. And that's really quite exciting. It's like, oh, God, yes, you know, I guess textiles doesn't have to be the, you know, sort of environmental or disaster that we thought, you know, that everyone thinks it is. Actually, things are moving on. So my big idea was, why don't we take all this material science and ways of doing things over from fashion and put it into the home? And that was the big idea. And funnily enough, I mean, something else happened on the way is it's actually Mark, my Amazon agency person. He decided that he was going to move to Australia, so he didn't want to do it anymore. So, you know, because we talked about, oh, should we do this together? And I said, like, oh, yeah. He said, no, actually, Mike, I've had a change of plan. I'm moving to Australia. I don't, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm just stick to the Amazon agency. I thought, that's cool. So I had this thing like, you know, should I do this? You know, I've just worked out there's a business here. You know, should I just, you know, take the ball and run with it? And the answer was yes. I was so excited. It's like, yes, I think there's, you know, again, big category, sustainably and functionally focused. You know, you can build small, but then go big. You know, from my eyes, there's a big unmet consumer need in terms of people want better made, better for you, better for the planet products, and in the world of the home, that's not really been done enough. There's some great brands out there, like Bedfolk are a good one. You know, Bedfolk are a fantastic brand, but you know, they're quite traditional. So let's have the opportunity to do something a little bit different. You know, material science, sustainability led, functional led. Let's go ahead and do it. And that's what we launched in June 2023. So just over a year ago, we came into the market with a bedding range made of tensile material, which is this fantastic wood-based material, really low water, really low carbon, really low chemical. But best of all, functionally, it was amazing to sleep in. It regulates your temperature. It's hypoallergenic. It keeps you cool. It does all these wonderful things. And ultimately, you get a good night's sleep. So everything seemed to be there. So we launched in 2023.
Mike, I think anyone listening can hear the passion you have for this idea still. I can only imagine how strong that passion was back in June 23 when you kicked everything off. But 12 months in a year, Chloe, 13 months later, you closed the whole thing down. So I guess, first off, why did you shut it down and how did you come to that decision?
Yeah, it was, you know, when we launched, I guess, you know, it was really evident to me very, very quickly that we had a problem. And, you know, essentially, if you want to get into the metrics of it, you know, once we got started, we realized we had sort of low purchase intent. It was a discretionary purchase. It means, you know, do most people, you know, can they wait? Do they actually need this? And the answer is, yeah, they can wait and actually might not need it. I mean, to think about, you know, how often you buy sort of homeware. So that was a real problem. And that was a bit of a timing problem. But also, you know, because of that, you had, like, you know, looking at the, you know, acquisition costs are just really high. And that is because there's not just enough demand in the system. And the other thing, because it's discretionary, you know, people can wait. And what's, you know, if you're waiting for, I guess, a high value item, you wait for a deal. And I guess this is the category taught people to do this as well. Whether it's Black Friday or, you know, summer sales or, any, you know, January sales, a particular time of year, you know, if you want something like bedding, you can just wait. And so, yeah, ultimately, we sold actually really well when we, you know, we entered into Black Friday and we did some deals, which initially, you know, deals weren't in the business plan. You know, we wanted to create something of value that people were prepared to pay for. But then we realized, oh, actually, you know, sales not very good, sort of off deal. Let's put it on deal and see what happens. And the answer was actually it sold pretty well, but we didn't have any margin. You know, if you sell only on deal, you just don't have the margin to operate. So, you know, that's not going to work as a business. But ultimately, where I learn, you know, on this journey, and I think sometimes you have to do things before you find this out. Essentially, the reason this business was never going to work is because we were solving a problem that people, or most people, actually weren't screaming to be solved.
So that's the problem of a better, more sustainable bedding. 90% of people are happy with random cotton sheets that they bought on discount when there was an offer on.
Yeah, and it's not 90%. It seems like 99%. And we always know, you know, when you build a new brand, especially a startup, you know, you've got a specific audience in mind. You know you're going to be relatively niche. But it was like we were niching on a niche. It was just too small. And, you know, it comes to me, it's a product market fit problem. I certainly did. I've been guilty of this. When I think about product market fit, I think too much about product. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, the product's not good enough. You know, it's not cheap enough, or it doesn't, you know, it's not good enough quality, or it doesn't do what it's meant to do. You know, it's a product problem. But in this instance, the product was fantastic. The problem was the market.
It is the case sometimes, isn't it, Mike, that part of the discovery journey of is this business going to work or not is to launch it and to see, you know, you can do everything you want to do on paper and in spreadsheets and with surveys and all the rest of it. But until you actually put it up on a website and see if anyone's willing to pay for it at a price that you can afford to do and at a volume you can afford to shift, you're not going to know if it's possible. So sometimes you have to launch in order to realize you shouldn't exist.
100% true. I mean, you can do market tests, right? There's lots of different ways of doing that. But ultimately, unless you've got a real product with a real price tag on it and essentially real customers, it's really hard to test, you know, are people actually going to go for this? And I do think for this business, there was a timing issue. You know, we're living in, you know, in the last couple of years, it's been incredibly tough in terms of, you know, consumer products, you know, everyone's skin, right? Or, you know, times have changed. So, you know, I guess big item purchases, it becomes more and more considered. So there is a timing problem. But ultimately, you know, we put a product out to market. And, you know, and I still, yeah, one of the things that really makes me a bit sad about this, and so it was, you know, everyone who bought the product, we had nothing but 5-star reviews. Mm-hmm. Everyone, I guess, sort of understood it and wanted it and it was the right product in the right place with the right person at the right time. They loved it. So that's fantastic. You know, it's 5 stars. But, you know, it was just my recognition that there is not enough of those people who, you know, who are prepared to spend the money, who value the product that we were going to make. Because it is quite different. It was a different product from your standard cotton sheet. So, you know, there's enough people to value that. But, yeah, there wasn't enough value. And for me, it just meant, you know, this business is not going to work. So, of course, we looked, you know, what can we change? Can we, you know, can we tweak? Can we make some incremental improvements? And ultimately, we could. Yes, we could change some things in terms of pricing. In terms of marketing, we could be better. We could have a better website. We could have better landing pages. We could have better ads, better offers, better emails, all the things you do. But where I got to in the end is like, even if we made things sort of 100x better, it still wasn't going to be enough from where we were. So that says it's going to be an awful lot of work, and you know the risk of failure was huge. So it was one of the things. It's like let's just not do this. And the way I think, you know, ultimately I would look back at this journey is that it's not that we sort of fell fast. We actually did a year market test. We spent a year in the market testing. Is this a business that we can build? And the market said no.
So I know some people listening would have gone, oh well, couldn't you have turned it into a one day a week business and just kept it on the side doing something whilst you worked on something else? Did you have to go to that, you know, that some might think of drastic as going, actually, test over, test failed, let's go on and do something completely different? Could you not have got like left it on the boil and come up with something else?
I think, yes, we could have done, but it would just be, it would be small and annoying if we did that, just to keep it going. I'm really frustrating. I mean, the other thing, but you have to hold stock and you have to have your website and do your accounting and do your VAT returns and all that thing. It's not really a day a week. It takes a lot of time. And the other thing about it is clearly it wasn't just a timing issue. There, you know, there was definitely some change that needs to be around sort of, you know, the product itself and positioning and the pricing and and all the things, there was just a lot of things to do to fix. And that means you can't do that. And sort of, you know, on a Monday evening when you've done it, when you put the kids to bed and done everything else, it's like, yeah, actually, this is a full-time job. So it just didn't make sense. The number for me, I was, you know, being very, very much sort of just fundamentally led by sort of the metrics is actually, this just doesn't make sense. It made perfect sense on paper. And the business plan was, you know, I had loads of the investors who, you know, I had investment for this. And I was like, Mike, this is one of the best business plans I've ever seen. Of course you can have some money. And I was like, yeah, great. But, you know, and this is what's amazing. Actually, we put all those plans into action and it just didn't work. Isn't that amazing?
It just shows you have to do that market test and that you've got to be ready to listen to the market once you're up and running. So if anyone listening is thinking they might be in a similar position to the one you were in, how do they go about making that decision to continue or to stop?
Well, I guess, you know, I really encourage all the clients that I work with, I really hope they've got some sort of strategy or business plan. You know, because people, you always think, oh, business plan. Business plans are only, you only write them. You write them for the bank manager, right? So hopefully it might give you a bit of money. But actually, no, they're not for the bank manager. They're for you. They're your strategy, your plan. They're, you know, this is the way you're going to grow. And if you look at your business and it's actually completely unaligned with your business plan, you've got a problem. You even need to write a new plan. Or, you know, you need to come up with a new way of working. Because if you're not hitting your numbers, you know, it's not just going to get better. You know, it's not a miracle's not going to happen. It's just going to continue to get worse. So I think you've got to be very real and say, look, you know, look, is my business generating the numbers it needs to grow and survive and thrive? You know, a startup business is never going to look in good shape at the start. You're probably going to be losing money. Your metrics are not very good. Your marketing can be a lot better. Blah, blah, blah. You know, you've got to do some things with your product. But ultimately, there needs to be some momentum. There needs to be some demand there. And then you've got the opportunity to fix those things. So if you've got momentum, that's great. And then, you know, you have to work really, really hard at fixing those things so you can make some money. But if you haven't got momentum and you're losing money, you've got a real problem there. And I think, you know, it's really easy to go in denial about that. It's like, I'll figure this out. Don't worry. I'm really committed to this. I will figure this out. But, you know, if the fundamentals are not there, it's not going to happen.
Would it be fair to say this is one of my favorite things I learned in my economics A level, the concept of the opportunity cost? You only have so many hours in a week and so much energy to put into something. And if you realize that you're building something that's going to be so hard to make work, the opportunity cost of continuing with it is that you don't get to go and do the other new thing. Does that play into it? You know, were you thinking, okay, I could keep chugging away at this, or I could stop, have another little sabbatical, write another book or something, and then come back with another idea in a couple of years that could get to where I want one to get quicker?
Completely right. I mean, the opportunity cost, I think a lot about opportunity costs, and I think it's something we all need to think more about, because every choice that we make, there is, you know, that's the thing you're doing, and all those other things you're not doing because you commit to doing that first thing. So yes, absolutely. I mean, and it would have been easy to raise some more money and to try and pivot or try and improve, or just, as you say, just try and hold your ground. That would have actually been an easier thing to do. You know, and there's a bit of an ego behind there as well. You know, I can't fail. Let's just try and, you know, I've really got to try and make this work. That would have been easy to do. But ultimately, I just knew, not only in sort of in my heart, but also in my head, this just doesn't make sense. This is a bad way. This is going to be a bad outcome for everybody. Let's just move on. And, you know, ultimately, you know, it's not very nice having to, you know, close down a business, especially a business that, as you said, I was really passionate about it as well. Really wanted it to work for lots of different reasons, but ultimately have to be happy that, you know, sometimes, you know, even with all of my experience and my knowledge, you know, sometimes it's just not going to work, and that's okay.
You mentioned the F word there, Mike. Failure. Was this a personal failure or was this something else?
For me, actually, no, it wasn't a personal failure at all. It's a frustrating failure, but it's not personal because, you know, I guess, you know, I had a plan, we had a team, we had investors, we all thought it was the right thing to do. and it just wasn't. I mean, some of that is timing, absolutely, but it just wasn't the right thing. Were there things we could have done a bit better? Absolutely. Yeah, I can't say, you know, everything we did was right. No, that would be wrong. But ultimately, you know, we were doing the right things to try and make this work. But, you know, it was the market that said no. It wasn't, you know, we weren't trying hard or doing the right things. So I don't see it. That absolutely was not a failure. And as I said already, I think we need to completely reframe this. This wasn't a failure. It was a market test that didn't, you know, and the market said no. So that's okay. We've actually been really successful with our market test. We didn't get the answer we wanted, but it was actually a really successful test.
Yeah, we did get an answer. That's, you know, a win, isn't it? I love that point. So, Mike, what's next? Are there new things you've learned from this you're going to take to your new idea, or is there something else coming up, or are you still in that mulling it over phase and you're not yet willing to tell us what's going to be next?
No, I mean, I continue to work hard. I mean, my big thing, my main thing has been for a while is consulting. So I help sort of startup and scale ups, all sorts of consumer brands, digital brands, so e-com, D2C, but also, I guess, multi-channel, so sort of real world, but always consumer goods. That's really my thing. So I continue to do that. But, you know, I've got a lot more learnings to help those brands now. I mean, I've always been very lucky, like with Innocent and then Peppersmith, yeah, actually pretty successful. So I've now got, you know, something that didn't go quite so well under my belt. So I think there's a degree of, you know, there's some empathy there in terms of, you know, with other founders. But there's also, you know, I guess that there's more lessons, you know, loads more lessons. And the one thing it did do, I mean, it was, you know, the brand, yeah, was out there for a year in the test. I got way more into digital marketing than I had been before. Because in Peppersmith, we did a lot ourselves, but we were losing a lot of agencies. But, you know, when we don't have a lot of money in the bank, and there's only really small team doing it, I'm going to be doing a lot of the work. So, you know, really got back into sort of Meta and Google and all the different things, and even Amazon. You know, even with Amazon, you know, there's loads of really brilliant Amazon agencies out there, but if you're a small brand, there's so much you can do yourself. You've just got to have the willingness and the time to do it. So, you know, just refresh myself in terms of how to do all the Amazon stuff. So that was great. So I guess there's all this, you know, lessons there. But ultimately, you know, I guess I'm always ready to do the next thing. I mean, I love just sort of bringing new products to market, especially the ones that are purpose-driven. So brands that are better for the consumer, but better for the world at large. You know, I love that. So consultancy do that. I now do more fractional work as well. So I guess I'm keeping busy, but also I'm still actually, you know, Kuroa as a business, you know, is not quite shut yet. It takes a long time to go through all of the steps you need to do to shut the business. I've actually just only this week shut down the VAT account, for instance, make sure there's no VAT, no more money, you know, sort of flowing in and out to HMRC. Because one of the things I did, I mean, and I guess this is worth saying, it was a very much of a controlled descent. Yeah, we shut the business with money in the bank. And so everyone was paid up. Yeah, money was in the bank. You know, there's actually a small allocation of cash to the investors. Not they're still going to be claiming on their next capital gains. Quite a big loss. But yeah, there is some money there. So it was very much controlled, which is so much better than, oh crap, we're insolvent. You hand it over to, you know, the insolvency practitioners, and then you don't touch it again, and your suppliers and lots of people don't, you know, are out of pocket. That's miserable. I mean, I guess one of the things I do, you know, very much in control of that cash. I knew this was coming, so when we decided it wasn't going to work, we were able to put the brakes on, stop the descent before we smashed into the ground.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are.
Have you yet downloaded our ebook? To celebrate reaching episode 500, we've created an epic e-commerce success-focused ebook for you, packed with 500 top tips about how to make your e-commerce store more profitable, featuring the advice of many, many past guests alongside industry experts and many of you as well, our listeners. I've checked every single tip and organize the whole thing into sections for you, making it super easy to dip in and dip out and take inspiration as and when you need it. This ebook needs to be sat on your desktop or even printed and sat on your desk. Download your free copy right now at ecmp.info/ebook. Get 2024's most valuable e-commerce ebook now, ecmp.info/ebook.
It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. So, Mike, are you ready for the top tips?
Oh, yeah, always ready.
Excellent. Okay, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
Well, of course, there is my book, so the Direct Consumer Playbook, which is very much recommended to anyone who is in D2C. But I can't plug my own book because you've already told me I can't do that. So we will talk about another book. So the book that I'm just about to start reading it again, and this is always the good sign of a book, right, when you want to give it multiple reads, and it's The Practice by Seth Godin. So I love all Seth Godin stuff, but the reason I love The Practice so much, it is just really, it's a collection essentially of his little blog posts. If you don't have his blog posts every day, you really just need to sign up to that. It's like 2 minutes of just extreme wisdom. The Practice is all a book about for entrepreneurs and creative folks, just in really encouraging them just to put great stuff out in the world. It's a brilliant book and it's so easy to read.
I'm all right with you vaguely plugging your book there. That's all right by me because it's a great read and it's often plugged by our other guests too. So, you know, why not? But loving the second recommendation as well. Traffic top tip. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
For me, the big marketing tip I've got for consumer brands, actually it works with sort of service and digital brands as well, but consumer brands is the easiest, is give stuff away. Be as generous as possible. And that could be with content, but you know, and some of the brands I wear, it's normally with products. But the thing you've got to do is make sure it's valuable. I'm not talking about giving away crap merchandise. It's either your products or, you know, something that is valuable to your consumers. But if you can do that, if you can give stuff away, it creates this amazing level of gratitude and loyalty. And it just enables, you know, your consumers to really love you, not just like you.
Nice strategy. Love that. Okay, the tool top tip. Maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
So I have got tool fatigue. there's so many great tools out there. And generally, I use them for a few months and then go on to the next thing. So I'm not going to plug tools because I don't know. There's always the next new one. I am going to talk about the way to work. And it actually comes from the Seth Godin book, The Practice, that we spoke about before. And one of the things that I really learned as I was writing, but it's the same in terms of all your businesses or your, you know, building your personal brand. We have to write a lot, right? So the big thing that I learned was not to wait for the muse or being in the right mood or any other excuse. It's just to get on with it, you know, just write, just create, get your head down and do it. And as Seth Godin would say, it's about being professional. Professionals don't wait for the muse. They just get on with it.
Oh, I like that. That's one to mull on. That is a great point. Okay. Carbon top tip. What's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
So I am super passionate about, I guess, sustainability and reducing carbons. Just a real way to do it. And I guess, you know, we could talk a long time about, you know, do you have carbon credits and all that sort of stuff? I'm not going to talk about that. I talk about real carbon. And one of the things that I always had to do, you know, I learned with Peppersmith when we had using our D2C store was to make ordering and selecting the right products as simple as possible. And the end result of that is you get happy customers who get what they want, but also you don't get returns. And if you don't get returns, it's less, you're going to, less hassle, less complexity, less money wasted, and also less carbon. So if anyone orders the wrong products, and the way I encourage every founder to think about this, if someone orders the wrong products, it's your fault, not theirs. So make it better.
Yeah, you can put all the clever returns management you like on the back end, but if you haven't done everything you can to make sure the customer buys the right product in the first place, you're just screwing it up. And it, yeah, and I totally agree. It's you, isn't it? It's you as the business owner. Love that. I could rant about returns for so long. Maybe we should do that next, Mike. right, Mike, thank you so much for all your advice in this episode and for being willing to talk about the closure of an e-commerce store, because I think it's something we all need to understand more, because sooner or later we'll find ourselves in that seat, quite likely. But before we do say goodbye to you, could you please let the listeners know where they can find you and your business on the web and social media?
Yep. So you can find me. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn a lot, so I meet a lot of people. So just search Mike Stevens or Mike J. Stevens is my little hook. Same as that's the same on Twitter as well. And then also my main website, which is my consultancy, is stevens.earth. So, you know, if you want to get in touch, just get on the website and drop me a note. I'd love to talk to you. If anyone's going through having any doubts about, you know, what they need to do next with their business, let me know. I'll talk you through, you know, is it going to work? Is it worth persevering? Or actually, should you think about shutting it down? Happy to help there. But anyone who just wants to get in touch and have a chat, I love talking about D2C and consumer brands. So always happy to do that.
That's an amazing offer, guys. Take him up on that offer, because Mike knows so much about D2C. Mikey, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been great getting to catch up with you again. So thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Always great to come on.
So there you go, the insights on how, when, why to go about closing down your e-commerce store. And I love a couple of the key things Mike said there about kind of reframing failure. It's not really a failure. It was, second thing I really liked, that idea of thinking of it as a 12-month market test. Is this idea actually going to work in practice, rather than on paper and in business plans and spreadsheets? And then the other thing I liked was that whole piece about opportunity costs. And I completely agree with him. We ought to be considering that more and more and more with the decisions we're making. If you want to hear about Mike's book, The Direct-to-Consumer Playbook, then go back to episode 390, where you'll find my interview with him about that. It is well worth getting a copy of. It's a great book. And you can get your hands on the notes from this episode, including those top tips and links to what we've mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also use the direct episode short links. Just put ecmp.info/the number of this episode into the URL bar and you'll go straight to the right episode page. That also works for episode 390, where we were talking about his book. So that would be ecmp.info/390. Now, when you get to the website, please do add yourself to our email list so you don't miss out on any of the other things we share to help you improve your business. And if you like this episode and you want to hear another take on how and why you might want to close a business, then we've done another one of these episodes way back, episode 154, yes, 154, where Christine Nicholson talks about how and why she decided to close her e-commerce subscription business, Divine Legs, that sold tights. So scroll a long way back up the feed or go to ecmp.info/154 to find out everything about that episode. And if you are looking at building a D2C brand, then ecmp.info/DTC will take you to a page on the website where we've brought together all our interviews with D2C brands. Thank you for tuning into this and every episode of the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. I bring you a new interview every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including becoming more sustainable. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. Have a great week and don't forget to keep optimizing, unless you should close your business, in which case stop optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.
It's time to download our 500 top tips to make your e-commerce business more profitable ebook. Go to ecmp.info/ebook now.